Alvarez versus the City of Chicago.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jack Katigan on behalf of the plaintiffs. The Caraballo case should have been decided on 9 questions of law, all of which pertain to the regular rate under the FLSA 207E. The actual pay under each of these 9 issues is uncontested fact, which is stored in the city's computerized payroll system for each of the plaintiffs on a per-payroll basis. That's in the record in the Caraballo document 56-8 under Jamison. Once the decision on the 9 legal issues is decided, an experienced computer programmer could change the algorithm in the city's payroll system to conform with that decision, and the damages to every plaintiff in both cases on an individual basis could be determined within a few hours. The city has already done this once after this court's decision in Alex versus the City of Chicago in 1995. In the record, it reflects that the city frequently does this. I would suggest you look at Caraballo, document 56-16, page 45, where they have done this in the past. Table 1 of my initial brief shows the claims of each of the 12 Caraballo people as it pertains to the 9 subclaims under the regular rate. A decision on Mr. Jamison, who has all 9 issues, would resolve all of the issues in this lawsuit. This court has decided a very similar case in Leahy versus the city, and that decision was refined in Jonitis versus Commonwealth Edison. As all the employees in both Caraballo and Alvarez have at least 3 common pieces to this regular rate violation, we have satisfied the Jonitis requirement, and it was an abuse of discretion to not have those 9 sub-issues decided as a matter of law. I would suggest that both cases pass what is termed to as the stomach test in the Jonitis. Defendant issued burdensome written discovery in both cases. All 12 Caraballo plaintiffs answered it, and 357 out of the 360 plaintiffs in Alvarez did as well. Judge Hibbler, upon learning of the Alvarez response, termed it a heroic response. In light of that, it was not proper to have this case dismissed on procedural grounds. The plaintiffs showed not that their attorney was interested in having this matter resolved. They showed that they were interested in having it resolved, and they are entitled to a decision on the merits, which this decision does not do. Because all of the 9 issues in the regular rate have to be decided, at least for Mr. Jamison and for many other people in the Alvarez case, nothing is gained by requiring these 2 cases to be filed in a multiplicity of lawsuits. Because of the number and the number of district court judges in this district, each court would have 12 to 13 cases if the city got its way to have these filed individually. The lucky judge who got Jamison would decide all of the issues for all of the cases, and there would be no need for any of the other judges to do anything. Why isn't that done in this one case? It isn't done because there was an abuse of discretion and a refusal to have a decision on the merits of the 9 legal issues. This problem of this heterogeneous versus homogeneous that has been come up is not going away, and this court needs to help the district court on this issue. I received a decision yesterday in another case where there was 50 plaintiffs. It's an identical situation. In fact, it is the paramedics who are also involved in this case, but 50 different ones. And the decision in that case is identical because there is the judge admits that the plaintiffs must be permitted to refile their claims in some form. What form that may be, we don't know, but in the form that it was drafted, it is not allowed. And it was suggested that I file 50 individual cases. Now, if that's what needs to be done, it will be an immense waste of judicial resources of this district. And we also face the possibility that we'll have more than one decision on the same issue of law.
Counsel, do I understand you to say you filed, you received a decision from another district court in a case similar to this?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did those circumstances arise post the?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, so they couldn't have been part of the proposed class here, is that right?
They didn't file as part of the class here, Your Honor.
That was because of some temporal issue?
It's a variety of issues, Judge. Not everybody. There's about 600 paramedics in the city of Chicago.
Understood.
They didn't all work during the entire period of time. Some of these paramedics didn't start until after the first lawsuit was initiated. So there's a variety of reasons for people not to participate in the Alvarez. And the Caraballo case was a result in part of four of the people in the Alvarez case being dismissed, and they were joined with eight other paramedics for the Caraballo case.
You represent all these?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. And they all pertain to nine legal issues where there are no factual disputes.
In this case, was the judge asked to convert it to an individual action? Did you actually ask the judge to do that?
Judge, the Alvarez case was an individual action. It is, if you look at the complaint, it is stylized that each one of them individually made a claim. There was no attempt in the Alvarez case, in the Caraballo case, the second case, there was no attempt, no request to have any notice to go out to have that.
Time is limited here. As I understand it, the judge would not certify and said this is appropriate for arbitration. But I don't know that there was ever a request made to, rather than arbitration, let's have individual lawsuits filed.
Your Honor, when we received the judge's initial decision dismissing, the posture of the case was the motion for summary judgment was made by plaintiffs in the Caraballo case. The decision was on not only the Caraballo, but also on the Alvarez. After that, we asked, at the day that the decision was entered, the judgment order was also entered on the docket, which normally doesn't happen until later. Nonetheless, we asked the judge to reconsider, for a variety of reasons, his decision, and drew to his attention that there would be a statute of limitations issue being raised by having these cases dismissed because of the nature of the FLSA. All of the requests were summarily rejected. The judge said that he'd already taken care of the case by the entry of the initial order.
Okay. And then finally, and just in practical terms here, what is wrong with the general idea that this should be arbitrated under the collective bargaining agreement.
Judge, the problem, that's a fool's errand. And the reason it's a fool's errand is because you are telling the plaintiffs, who have absolutely no control as to whether that ever will occur, that your case should be arbitrated. Well, but they can't require it to be.
Wouldn't the union be interested in, you know, I think they're always interested in getting more money they can for their members.
Judge, there are competing interests in unions. And there's a variety of reasons why arbitrations are not taken. And the union is not to be faulted for that reasoning. They don't breach their duty of fair representation by not doing so, and they're not required under the contract to do so. It's their discretion. And so to suggest that the plaintiffs should go to a place where they can't force a decision is a fool's errand. Now, another court in this district has stayed the case and let the parties see if arbitration can occur. Now, that makes sense. And that case will be reviewed by that district court after that process is ended, one way or the other. But that didn't happen here. This case was dismissed, both of them. Now, I would suggest the case should be reversed and remanded with instructions to decide the nine issues. If you disagree with me that there was no abuse of discretion, then I believe that under Federal Rule Civil Procedures 20 and 21, that the cases should be remanded for decision, nevertheless, on the nine issues for the original 54 plaintiffs in Alvarez and for the 12 plaintiffs in Caraballo. And the opt-in plaintiffs will be left to their own devices. But the 54 in Alvarez and the 12 in Caraballo are entitled to a decision on the merits, which is a decision on nine issues. If the court does not feel that it should decide the damages, the case can be sent to the magistrate judge or a special master can be retained to make that decision. This court, the district court, never needed to decide how much money each one of the plaintiffs are entitled to. It was only this hyper fabrication by the defendant to make these cases appear much more complex than they were. It's nine issues. With that, I will reserve the rest for
later. Ms. Bach?
May it please the court. The FLSA requires that plaintiffs be similarly situated in order to proceed with a collective action. The plaintiffs here cannot meet this basic requirement. Not only do they fail...
Why don't you tell us what's wrong with his point about the nine legal issues? Why is that incorrect?
Just to make sure I'm addressing your question...
Well, he's made an argument. He says there are only nine legal issues. Just decide those and the whole case goes away. What's your answer to that?
Certainly. The plaintiffs have consistently tried to oversimplify this case, and in fact, there's 10 legal issues here.
You're saying they're oversimplifying. They're saying you're over complexity. So let's try to find out where the middle ground is here.
Certainly. The first answer is that under traditional tests, to be a similarly situated plaintiff, you need to allege a violation of a single policy. Here they're alleging a violation of 10 policies. And not only are they alleging a violation of 10 policies, but not every plaintiff can bring every claim. In fact, the claim arising from the policy for specialty pay applies to less than 20% of the plaintiffs here. The notion that these claims could all be resolved on legal issues is also a fallacy. If you look at the claim for human computation errors, which is one that the plaintiffs have routinely ignored here, that's actually a claim that varies plaintiff by plaintiff. If you have 300 and some plaintiffs bringing claims for human computation errors, you need to look at the evidence related to each of the 300 and some plaintiffs, because there's no common theme for what those errors actually were. The same thing happens if you start looking at the claims for uniform pay, if you start looking at the claims for continuing education. All of these have individual fact-based issues that vary from plaintiff to plaintiff. And again, when you have over 300 plaintiffs bringing them, there's just not a silver bullet for how to resolve them. I think it's telling that counsel, when he was up here,
You're saying they're not just nine legal issues, they're umpteen mixed law and fact issues.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Well, why isn't the computation as to individual monies, if they're due, not just a ministerial matter, Ms. Buck?
I think there's two answers to that question. The first is, opposing counsel was referring to this algorithm, and all you have to do is change up the algorithm and push a button, and you'll get an answer. And the reality is it's just not that simple. There is the issue of what gets included into the regular rate, and that would be relevant to the computer program he's referencing. But there's a separate issue that goes to something called premium pay, and whether or not those are counted and how they offset the regular rate payments is much more complicated than just that. But even setting aside the damages question, you still have all these fact questions, again, not to harp on it, but with the human computation errors.
Why don't you give us an example of the complexity that would attend the fact that, pick any two of the 300 potential class members and explain why the facts would be significantly different in any case.
Sure. One example that the plaintiffs actually mentioned in their reply brief is the question of uniform pay. And there, uniform pay is either included or excluded from the regular rate, depending on whether or not it's a reasonable compensation for the amount that the plaintiffs would expend to care for and maintain their uniforms. And I think it's significant because even plaintiffs identify that they would contest whether or not this is reasonable, which in the case of each plaintiff, then you would be looking at, well, how many shifts did they work? How many times did they have to change their clothes? Let's drag out their dry cleaning bills and go through those and see, you know, what's going on with each of these different plaintiffs.
But does the city really want to attend to 300 separate complaints? Put aside the venue, whether it's arbitration or United States District Court or Magistrates Court. Is it the city's position that it's unfairly called to defend in a situation like this, as opposed to a multiplicity of settings?
I mean, certainly every claim that the plaintiff has brought needs to be adjudicated on its merits. I think the method that the plaintiffs have gone about pursuing this lawsuit has been extraordinarily problematic, starting with filing a complaint that didn't specifically list claims, and then you have this opt-in period where anybody who's a paramedic virtually will opt in, and then discovery pursues, and it's this sort of fishing expedition to try and find out, well, what claims do we really have for all these plaintiffs? And then you end up with this amalgamation of 10 different claims that some people have and some people don't. The whole process here has been highly unusual and highly burdensome for everybody, but that being said, I do think all these claims need to be adjudicated on their merits, and I don't think there's a silver bullet. If you follow the plaintiff's logic, this could go to trial, and we could have 300 plaintiffs asserting 10 claims in front of a jury for the next 2 years, or this could go through individual suits, but you still have to identify and deal with each of these claims on the merits. It's the city's position, however, that either individual lawsuits or arbitration would be a better venue for accomplishing those means than doing it through an extraordinarily drawn-out jury trial.
What if it were to be determined that, well, let me first ask, how many plaintiffs do we have potential class members in this case? I think the council said 300. I may be mistaken.
Sure. I think total, you know, there's been some shifting one way or the other, but it's right around 380 total.
If discovery were to produce a situation where 200 members had 7 of the 10 claims in common, apart from individual computations, would that seem to be an appropriate class? if that were to be the case?
The position is that would not be an appropriate class. Both under this court's recent holding in Jonides, the Exelon, and other circuits' utilization of what's called the two-part test, in either situation, that wouldn't qualify. In particular, under your hypothetical, I think you identified 7 claims in common. The plaintiffs have been less ambitious and identified just 3. But under either situation, you have some plaintiffs who can't assert all claims, and that is enough to get you within the holding in Jonides to find that you're not meeting the FLSA requirement to be similarly situated. If you look at the two-part test applied in other circuits, they also have a requirement that you assert a violation of a single policy. And again, even if you have 7 policies in common, that's more than one, and that would get you outside of the FLSA requirement under those tests. So under either test, I think it's significant that you can't meet the requirement. I'd also highlight the plaintiff's response here. When you've tracked their arguments through to their reply brief, by that time they've stopped arguing that they fall within Jonides and stopped arguing that they're asserting a unified or a single policy, and instead falling back on this notion that, well, it's more efficient and that will overcome any sort of statutory shortcomings on their part. Not only is a perceived efficiency not a reason to circumvent FLSA requirements, but in fact, collective action is simply not the most efficient means of addressing these claims. In advancing their argument, the plaintiffs present a false dichotomy, arguing that their only options are to file individual lawsuits or a collective action. Tellingly, they're silent about the possibility of arbitration, a process that could streamline the most troublesome parts of this case. Nor is it clear that individual actions are any less efficient. Undoubtedly, this case presents varied and complex issues, and there's no silver bullet here. Resolution of these claims in any forum will need to address the merits of all the issues. And, of course, there's many ways to manage individual actions in an orderly manner, such as staying some cases while allowing test cases to proceed. As a result, plaintiffs cannot use arguments concerning efficiency to make an end run around FLSA requirements. The plaintiffs also challenged the district court's decision to dismiss the 65 named plaintiffs. But the plaintiffs never requested that the district court allow the named plaintiffs to continue with the action upon decertification. I believe that was your question, Judge Evans. And in any event, the outcome is consistent with case law. First, although the plaintiffs were aware that the city was seeking the same type of relief as provided in Jonides, they never once asked this court to allow the case to proceed on behalf of the 65 named plaintiffs. It's difficult to see how the district court could have abused its discretion then in this situation when it didn't consider an argument that was never presented to it. In any event, the decision to dismiss the named plaintiffs is consistent with this court's holding in Jonides. There, the court did not convert the action once it had determined that the plaintiffs were not similarly situated, but instead dismissed it altogether. And while plaintiffs cite some cases for the proposition that upon decertification, a lawsuit will normally be converted, here it doesn't make any sense to do so because the 65 named plaintiffs were essentially a de facto collective action. The plaintiffs can offer no explanation for why proceeding with 65 named plaintiffs would avoid any of the problems that the court identified with the original collective action. As a result, should plaintiffs wish to proceed with their true individual actions, they can refile their claims. And, of course, should plaintiffs wish to proceed collectively, they may elect to pursue arbitration. The only option foreclosed at this point is pursuing a collective action in district court. Because the plaintiffs failed to allege a violation of a single policy, and because not all plaintiffs can allege all claims, the district court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing this case. For these reasons and the reasons articulated in our brief, we urge this court to affirm.
The allegations in the complaint, in both complaints, this is federal court, it's not state court. I have to give them, not fact pleading, I have to tell them what my complaint is. The complaint is simple. They failed to follow the regular rate. The regular rate under the FLSA says that all remuneration must be added together for the determination of what a person's hourly rate of pay is to compute time and a half for overtime on a weekly basis. All remuneration is simply that. There are eight exceptions. They are expressly stated in 207E. None of the nine issues are exceptions under the regular rate of pay. Now, the fact that they pay in a multiplicity of manners means that they complicate their pay plan. And now they get to defend their violation because they have compounded and made it so complex that people run out of the room when they listen to what they've done and say, I can't deal with it. I don't think that that's what the courts are designed for. They fail to pay the regular rate.
I would assume that all these things are in the pay plan because of arbitration or for collective bargaining. This fitness a bonus that you get. I mean, that's something that was, I assume, was collectively bargained, and they award certain members of the department who keep themselves in reasonably good shape.
Well, Judge...
So they get all these things as a result of being involved in the collective bargaining process.
That may be, but I don't sue under the collective bargaining agreement. I sue under the violation of a federal statute, and the collective bargaining agreement does not trump it. The Supreme Court has told us that. And the fact that they make a collective bargaining agreement complex does not mean that they should be able to avoid being in compliance with the FLSA.
But the collective bargaining agreement does make it difficult to this pay structure makes it difficult to determine what a regular, quote, pay.
Your Honor, I absolutely agree with that. And whose fault is that? My clients? My clients don't negotiate it. My clients don't decide what's in there. My clients merely work. And they work for pay. And they have not been paid time and a half the regular rate under the Fair Labor Standards Act. The fact that it happens in nine different ways does not avoid that fact. And, Judge, they say that they have to break this down. The regular rate is one rate. Mr. Jamison has all nine of them. If you would decide Mr. Jamison, you would decide all.
Your light is on here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Is Mr. Davis here? Ralph Davis, the attorney in the next case? All right. The court's been informed that...